I want to thank everybody first for coming out on kind of a disgusting evening. We're going to be talking about the problems with economic growth. It seems that one of them is that we get these late September heat waves in the North Atlantic seaboard. I mean, I was reading today that, you know, climate scientists who have a lot to be astonished by these days are pretty astonished by these temperatures and the level of humidity over the past couple of days. So thanks for coming out in spite of the soupy weather, and I especially want to thank Jenny and Chris and the Artists Institute for making the perhaps questionable decision of deciding to categorize me as an artist over the next couple of months. I have written fiction on some plays, but really this will be a non-fiction, although it was a speculative kind. After tonight's talk, I'll be giving a lecture or something like that on October 18th, I think it is, on steady state aesthetics, as I'm calling it, in which I'm going to try and think about the way in which our sense of art and our aesthetic sense may be changed after 50 years of kind of the explicit promotion of growth, and in a sense, 500 years of a kind of sustained capital growth of a sort that is pretty unique in human history, and which clearly coincides with the emergence of what we, in the broadest sense, can think of as modern art. So I think that it's difficult to imagine that art would have occurred as it did without the growth paradigm, as certain historians have called it, and it seems to me unlikely that art will remain, in our sense of the world aesthetically, will remain unchanged by the end of economic growth, should it come about, which is something that Gopal and I are going to talk about this evening. To put things as schematically as possible, we're going to talk about sort of two types of the end of growth. There's this kind of capitalist nightmare of the end of growth, which to a degree we're already probably witnessing right now, that's to say. And I read in the New York Times the other day that median household wealth in the United States is no more than it was in 1997, that's to say 20 years ago. So of course there's been some pretty considerable economic growth since then, but the gains in stagnation for most people. I was reading today that since the recession, something like 22% of white households in the United States are wealthier, and something like 2% of Hispanic households, something like 2% of black households. Everybody else is just running in place, and maybe running faster and faster to stay in place, or in fact falling behind. I think, you know, when we look at just most recently Germany, but you can think of just about any country in the wealthy world, one of the things that sort of this semi-stagnation in the past 10 years or so has produced is obviously these sort of populisms of left and right. People think on one hand, maybe I'm going to have to become a real leftist and vote for Die Linke in Germany or for Bernie here or for Corbyn, or maybe I'll just become sort of racist populist and decide the reason that the economy's in trouble is that immigrants are stealing out jobs and so forth. So it's pretty clear that capitalism runs into trouble when you don't have sustained economic growth. And Gopal's going to talk a bit about why that may be our situation right now, and that what I'm going to talk about, he'll talk about it in the context of what the classical political economists called the stationary state, a state on the other side of growth. And what I'm going to talk about is the way in which this sort of ostensibly nightmare scenario that we're living through right now of slow or no economic growth, the way in which this might actually be turned into a type of utopia, that's to say an ecologically sustainable and an economically just society that we would actually be content to live in and that might have some future unlike this one. So now I'll turn it over to Gopal.
While I had a somewhat lengthier presentation I was going to give, but I'll try to keep it as short as
That was just my intro. You still have your 15 minutes.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to do 15 minutes first, and then I was going to follow you. Okay. That was real short. Okay. Well, one of the things that's interesting about Marx's understanding of the historical arc of the development of capitalism is the
idea that people associate with Marx, that capitalism, although an extraordinarily dynamic economic system, unprecedented in its capacity to generate wealth, and you see this tribute to it in the Communist Manifesto, but that's a theme throughout his work, eventually hits limits to its capacity to continually expand. It's a system that depends upon expansion, and yet Marx's theory is an attempt to work out not just these cyclical crises, but the outer limits of capitalist development. And in a certain sense, capital is a proof that across this pattern of explosive economic development, capitalism generates internal barriers to its perpetuation. So the barriers are not simply external ones of the kind that classical political economy conceived of. And if you remember, classical political economy, Adam Smith and Ricardo, had their own version of the end of economic growth. We generally think of Adam Smith as being the kind of ideologue of the capitalist system, or classical political economists as being kind of blind-eyed in their admiration of what they thought of as commercial society, but all of them, in a way, accepted the idea that this pattern of economic development, which was characteristic of modern times, would eventually peter out and come to an end. And in a way, Marx did not wholly, of course, accept the framework in which they conceived of this whole socioeconomic process of development and the class division that it gives rise to. But he tried to figure out a way to conceive of how the pattern development, and his vision of this pattern development, was much more expansive, much more revolutionary in its understanding of how capitalism would generate more and more income and expand outward than the vision we have in economic development in Smith and Ricardo. So, one of the themes in Marxism has always been crisis theory. And sometimes these crisis theories have focused upon the periodic or cyclical crises, but now we're in a period where, you know, you can say a cyclical or conjunctural crisis, which we've been experiencing since the 1970s, is potentially, or it's conceivable, arguable, that it's converging with a structural crisis of a kind that reveals the outer limits of the capitalist system of the kind that Marx foresaw, and Marxists in the more distant past once thought was going to materialize imminently. And because it didn't materialize in the time that they were living in, often enough Marxists thereafter have said, okay, this means that capitalism can always continue, that this pattern of development can continue indefinitely. The only way we can imagine it coming to an end is if workers or the population undergoing capitalism does something about it politically. So now we're in a period in which you can say the capitalist system is deeply in crisis, and yet systemic alternatives to it have been fundamentally ruled out. So in a way, it's a case, a situation, a historical situation, which bears some resemblance to the 1930s, the last time in which people thought that the world capitalist system was coming to an end. Then, of course, there were not just populisms of the left and right, but a much more extreme polarization of left and right. There were fully blown revolutionary movements or states that in some way claimed the legacy of those revolutionary movements and wanted to promote them. The system was in, the world market had collapsed, and there were communist parties organized into an international in one pole, and there was an emerging counter-revolutionary right-wing response in the form of fascism. So, you know, one of the things we should keep in mind is to what extent does our political situation, to what extent will it come to resemble, in a way, the kind of outlines of the world that we thought, most people, many people in the West thought, had been left behind in the aftermath of the 1930s, with this long period of economic expansion and the stabilization of capitalist democracy. Okay, one of the, I can really kind of avoid the economic arguments and the kind of detail of them for the purposes of this talk, but in some way, the argument that I'm presenting, or have presented elsewhere, rests upon Robert Brenner's basic conception of the pattern of capitalist development in the world since the 1970s, onset of a world economic crisis in the 1970s, with the follow-up that the world economy has never really recovered since then, and that much of what we see since then is a pattern of ongoing adaptation to the slowing down of growth in the core of the system. Now, this is paradoxical, because this is a period, which has witnessed the slowing down of rates of growth in the core of the system. This is a period of this massive outward expansion of the system. So it seems paradoxical to describe it as an era of a long downturn of the capitalist system. So, you know, if you think about the world since the 1970s, it's seen the eradication of the communist bloc, the incorporation of China into the world economy, the elimination of radical third world nationalisms and the statist kind of economic projects that were associated with that. Of course, it's also been associated with a very substantial defeat of the labor movement within the core of the system. So in many respects, you might think the capitalist system, especially since 1989, has been doing swimmingly well. Now, so, in fact, throughout the 90s, you might remember the 1990s, there was a very optimistic vision of the future of the capitalist system in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was sort of generally foreseen that there was a 50-year or more horizon of expansion ahead. And so it's an irony, I would say, a historical irony, that not too long after the collapse of the communist bloc, the capitalist system finds itself in a period of seemingly interminable structural crisis. If we could think in terms of 50 or 75 years ahead in 1990, I thought we could, it's not really clear what's going to happen in the next 2 years with respect to how we're seeing things now. And this isn't just people like ourselves, this is at the top as well. So what happened, we can ask? What was moving in the deep all along that has in some way surfaced such that the capitalist system is in the situation that it's in? And of course, when I say this, I don't mean to say that the crisis of the capitalist system will issue forth in any progressive political alternatives or solutions. In fact, one of the themes, of course, of the Frankfurt School in the 1930s is why does the crisis of the capitalist system often issue in the rise and emergence of attempted right-wing and radical right-wing solutions? And so we might, in a certain sense, think about this in terms of our present political context. So, one of the characteristic features of this slowing down of the growth of income, present and question answer period, the kind of backdrop economics of how that and why that has happened, is the one of the most striking manifestations of it is, of course, this period of the nearly uninterrupted system-wide growth of debt. So you can say that the slowdown that I'm speaking of has been, in a certain sense, counteracted by this growth of debt, so that the system, in some sense, putting it crudely, is allowed to stay afloat. So the level of aggregate demand on the part of the larger consuming population is kept afloat. This allows a whole range of businesses that would not be able to survive otherwise to make a profit, and so on and so forth. But of course, it's a process which eventually has to come to an end. If wealth and income is not expanding, then claims on future wealth, which is what financial assets are valued in terms of, do not materialize, and this cannot go on. So we saw the first shakeout manifestation in 2008, and you could say the period politically we're living in is the aftermath of that. And there's been a very successful, so far, restabilization of the system, but one which was not able to shift the track, basically, of the system onto a more viable or sustainable form of capitalism. We didn't go back to pre-neoliberal capitalism. We more or less went further down the same path. So it's very likely that in the near future that we will get a repeat on a very large scale of what happened in 2008, and that we will not see a subsequent restabilization. And so the sort of steady state landscape that we should be thinking about politically, culturally, economically is the one that's going to really emerge in the aftermath of this. And of course, the way in which this is going to unfold is not predictable, and of course there will be kind of various counteractive measures which will kind of prop up the system all the way down, allowing it to continue to hull forth. But I do not really think that there is going to be a, let alone a successful kind of restabilization system. I don't even really think that we're going to get back to the crappy performance that we've seen of the whole system since 2008. So that's a new world in certain respects, and it's not just in terms of a slowing down versus the vis-a-vis the high point of growth that we saw in the aftermath of the Second World War, but really a slowing down vis-a-vis the historic performance of the system since its, well, I would say, early 19th century origins. So one of the things I'd say politically to keep in mind, though, is that, the paradoxes and ironies, here's another one. The period that we're living in is has exhibited these features which are, to all appearances, ultra-capitalistic, right? This skyrocketing growth of inequality, this gigantic financialization process which has embraced the entire world economy, and everyone is aware in a way that perhaps 30 or so years ago people would find different terms for this, that we live in a capitalist world. Okay, so one of the strange things about this ultra-capitalist kind of neoliberalism that we've experienced is that, I argue, that really what we're seeing underneath that is the emergence of a system which has come to ever more rely upon public debt and public bailouts. So there's a kind of perverse socialization of the economic process whereby the primary costs are borne by savers and taxpayers. And so the return to capital is increasingly being publicly subsidized and propped up at great public expense. And so the next financial crisis will confront populations across the world with the choice of whether they want to continue to prop up a market system which doesn't generate growth and periodically crashes at great public expense, or whether or not they should begin to dismantle and phase out the market. And in that kind of scenario, I see, despite the absence of any massive movements of an anti-capitalist sort, I see the objective conditions of possibility for a transition to an economic order beyond capitalism.
I realized that I forgot to do a little bit of I meant it to be justification for my inclusion in this program at the Artists Institute, which is to say, well, we won't really go into this now, but it's clear that there. I mean, in some sense, like an operation that began long ago with Duchamp or whoever, has really proceeded at a pace, and there's a kind of breakdown between the distinction between art and non-art that, in a way, this has been going on for a very long time, but it seems more radical in our moment, and it takes different forms. I mean, you have someone like Chris Krauss sort of talking about, right, she wrote an essay in Plus One a couple of years about this, about people sort of setting up an ordinary shop in Minnesota, and they sort of, in a sense, put a frame around it and call it art, and it's meant to sort of attract the type of attention that I get, the kind of concentrated attention we give to works of art. And I think two of artists named Cameron Rowland, who was in the Whitney Biennial, and who'd mounted on the wall a contract that he'd taken out with money from Whitney on some, what do they call it? I forget what type of bonds are called, sort of social impact bonds. But essentially, I mean, he was sort of laying bare a certain economic or financial process and asking people to think about it and not trying to afford any particular visual pleasure. It's on the wall to be thought about and not so much to be gawked out as some beautiful thing might be. So I think we can think about on some other occasion why it should be the boundary between art and non-art seems particularly porous at this moment. But anyway, to the degree that it does, I hope that justifies the inclusion of guys like us in the program. As I said, sort of, schematically, we can see looking around at why capitalism doesn't handle no growth very well, and something Gopal didn't go into, but that he's discussed in a very brilliant article in the New Left Review from a few years ago, is some of the reasons that even a better managed capitalism might have a difficult time attaining the sort of rates of growth that have historically characterized the system. For example, just thinking about it, we can see how you can make agriculture that much more efficient and free up all this labor and all these resources for industry. You can make that industry that much more efficient, and then you're left with all these people in what we call the service economy. And it's much less clear to everyone, I think, how you make services suddenly much more efficient in the way that you can make growing potatoes or turning out pig iron. And even to the extent that services become a great deal better, because they're not fungible in the same way, because they're not material in the same way, it's hard to measure such growth as does take place. That's to say, a service like, whether it's teaching, probably you can measure whether people get better doing something like teaching a language, but the extent that services involve things like, psychological support to people, being a social worker, being a psychiatrist or something, how are we to measure growth? Whether people are getting better and more efficient at providing a type of commodified psychological support to one another. It's a kind of theoretical question that's much more difficult to answer than whether a country is producing wheat or iron more efficiently than in the past. This brings us to, one of the difficulties in talking about growth is that it means a few different things simultaneously, things that are connected but that are not the same. I would say at a minimum we've got three types of growth. There's the growth that's just GDP growth that all economists and sort of all news articles even refer to, that we just take for granted, that there ought to be year-on-year GDP growth. And you'll see that if you sort of notice this and read news articles with an eye to this, you'll see that it's almost always the context of the discussion of any particular country's circumstances. And one of the reasons Puerto Rico's in such straits right now is because growth there is very low. It's thought that certainly something driving the sort of political polarization of many Europeans is low rates of growth and so forth. And so this is just alluded to constantly, and that's a kind of gross rate of growth. A second version that I think in some sense is more important is basically per capita growth, because of course it doesn't really, the reason a country like Holland is a very wealthy country, and say Nigeria is a poor country, their GDP may be similar, but of course, like we're dividing it by many fewer people in the case of this small European country, and many more people in this case of this other one. So of course, it's really per capita growth and per capita income that matters. There's a lot of talk in the financial press, there has been for a long time, about Japan's stagnation, which isn't great, but when you've got a declining population, it doesn't look so bad. That's to say, per capita income isn't doing too badly in Japan because the population is not increasing a lot. And then I think we need to think also of biophysical growth, which the ecological economists do, which is to say, growth in the physical sense of the term, which is analogous to the way in which all of us as organisms, as systems, grew for 18 years or so, and then we more or less stopped growing. We didn't cease to develop then, but we didn't require any greater inputs of food, shelter, or so forth, just to keep the system ticking over. A lot of things that we consider of interest have happened to us, presumably, since then, but they don't involve biophysical growth of our own organism. These things are, of course, closely connected, I think, very good sort of ecological Marxist thinker, Jason Moore, has demonstrated satisfactorily to my sense that it's not just increasing increasingly efficient uses of labor that have characterized the or accounted for the dynamism of the capitalist system, but what he calls a kind of rising ecological surplus. That's to say, it wasn't just that you could get more and more out of an hour's worth of labor, but that it was easier to come by this unit of wood, this unit of copper, this unit of petroleum. And that's not going to be possible forever, and indeed maybe ceasing to be possible as we speak. So these things are, of course, connected. I think, you know, Gopal's just sort of laid out the way in which some sort of incipient socialization may lie behind capitalist stagnation. I think this poses us, this confronts us with the question about whether a slow or no growth economy can be better managed by capitalists or by socialists, if there are to be actual socialists. Once again, this was, in a way, turned on its head, a big question of the 20th century. That is to say, who could do growth better? So quite schematically, you might say, in our century, we need to think about who could do no growth better. And you know, this really was quite explicitly a question of the wealthy Western capitalist countries after the Second World War. One of the big impetuses behind the standardization and the publication of national income statistics was that it was perceived, without the Soviet Union producing its GDP figures, it was perceived that the Soviet economy was really going great guns, and that the Western economy started producing five-year plans in quite, at least in that sense, sort of Stalinist fashion. That's to say, we hope that 5 years hence, our economies will be this much bigger, and then after 5 years after that, they'll be this much bigger. So there was a sense that there was a sort of race going on between socialism and communism, or whatever we want to call it, the Soviet system, in terms of who could do growth better. I think that in our time, when it's clear to everybody who is, I think being honest with themselves, that biophysical growth on a system-wide level, that is the system of human civilization, can increase and in fact may need to decrease. There are these statistics published that in, 2008, it took sort of, the lifestyle of the planet, as it were, would require 1.5 Earths to maintain. Of course, there aren't 1.5 Earths. So consumption and agriculture, if anything, needs to be decreased. So if we recognize that there's both that capitalism is running out of steam and that it kind of needs to run out of steam in terms of its constantly increasing biophysical throughput, then there becomes a question of, then there emerges a question about who can manage the lack of growth or even degrowth. We don't talk about that a whole lot in English, but in Europe, there is something of a degrowth movement, or as they say in French, décroissance, which, though small, is not non-existent as it is in the United States and in Britain, speaking of wealthy countries. A question, and a very, very important one, the one that we can maybe postpone until a little bit later, is the relationship between countries that may need to degrow and countries that clearly need to go about further growth in order to raise the standard of living to something that there ought to be. So, forgetting for a moment about GDP growth, how do you go about stabilizing biophysical growth at a tolerable level? There are various ways we can imagine doing this, but I think it clearly seems imperative that this should happen, or ecological ruin is assured. And at least in theory, we can then let growth of value take care of itself. In the most simplistic terms, you might imagine an economy where the whole thing is just a bakery. That's all it is. And so in biophysical terms, you'd say we can only use this much water, this much yeast, this much flour, this much sugar. We've got fields where we grow sugar cane or beets, like Colorado, where a lot of sugar comes from, and not from cane, but from beets. We've got this much wheat. And then you could stabilize these inputs, right? And then presumably you would have a growing economy if you had your various pastry chefs become increasingly good at turning out pastry. But at a certain point, any improvements, any growth would become rather notional, right? And improvements would really reflect the degree to which people's preferences were better satisfied by, like, a mille-feuille or a croissant or, you know, some sort of hearty or type of bread or whatever. But at least in theory, you can have sort of growth in terms of utility, in terms of preferences, while you've got a biophysical steady state. So ecological economics doesn't imagine sort of putting a cap on GDP growth, but putting a cap in terms of fundamental resources. The great ecological economist Herman Daly, one of whose essays we republished, proposes three basic sort of institutional parameters for a steady state. One of them is what he calls depletion quotas. Basically, biophysical sort of matter energy doesn't come in generic terms. You've got all sorts of specific things, like, say, this sort of mineral or petroleum or groundwater or so forth, or timber. And so you set a limit to how much timber can be logged from here, how much copper can be mined from there, and so forth. And then sort of auction off permits to do this. And you want to probably cap things at the level where they're originally extracted rather than the level where they're kind of they emerge as pollution. That's to say, it's easier to observe and control how much carbon is being emitted if you monitor not tailpipes, but take a look at oil fields and oil refineries around the world and so forth. There are many fewer of those than there are of tailpipes. A second one has to do with the stabilization of population, since, as we've already discussed, growth doesn't have anything to do with the quality of human life except as this relates to the population. And clearly, the best way to stabilize population, if you want to do that, reduce the reproduction rate, is to educate women as well as possible and to give them ready access to contraception and abortion. There are other schemes, and Daly talks about this, the ways in which you might go about stabilizing or reducing population in a non-coercive way or minimally coercive way. But nevertheless, this is sort of the third rail of all these discussions. As we see, like in Japan or in many European countries, it has required a sort of anti-natalist government policy to get birth rates below replacement rate. You can have institutions that would kick in to sort of encourage the population not to grow if the economy is not growing. And then last of all, because if in a no-growth economy, but you're running basically a zero-sum game, you'd want a guaranteed minimum income and also probably a maximum income so that no one is getting too much and also too little. It becomes, I think, the extent that it has even been tolerable at all under conditions of growth, that the rich should forever get richer, that we should have compounding capital accumulation. This has not, of course, been perfectly tolerable to everybody over the past few centuries, but I think it becomes something a great deal less tolerable to the extent that it becomes, it's perceptible to everybody that it's a zero-sum game and that capital will not accumulate without, capitalists will not have more and more, and wealthy people will not have more and more without everybody having less and less. It seems to me that the great weakness in this kind of quite visionary outline of a steady state economy, which would be a kind of, in a sense, a utopia, as opposed to the dystopia of growthlessness under capitalism, the weakness in this account of things is simply that there's no model of transition between where we are now and this ideal form of a steady state economy. And we know that transitions between modes of production and types of social formation are complex and take a very long time. But nevertheless, the difference between Engels' old difference between utopian versus scientific socialism was that the utopians just said there's this ideal form of world that ought to come about, and why doesn't everybody just ethically reform themselves so it does come about? And the Marxists were scientific in his terms because they said, well, there's actually a way that this is going to happen historically. This is the way that the system from within itself will produce another type of system. I think we need to think about whether and how that might happen. Some preliminary suggestions about how we might get from the sort of ecocidal capitalist stagnation that we're in now to and steady state of economy that was sort of eco-socialist, let's say. Some preliminary ideas about how this might come about, I think, have to do with the disadvantages of capitalism under conditions of no growth. On the one hand, rocketing income inequality in a zero-sum game, as we just talked about, becomes less tolerable. And another slightly more technical problem for capitalism is simply that you really tend to increase what Keynes would call the liquidity preference, which is to say, if a capitalist thinks, I don't know how to make a profit in an economy that's no longer really growing, well, that's going to tempt you, at least if there's not too much inflation, to just sit on your money, because how are you going to make a decent return? It seems to me, to the extent that we socialize investment, there's a real advantage then to socialism, because socialized investment, as opposed to private investment for the sake of private profit, can tolerate and even socialized investment can be quite content to say it's not clear that there's going to be any gain in terms of profit that we might even socialize. It's not clear that there's going to be any gain from this particular investment, whether in wind farms or in solar panels or in more sustainable agriculture or types of houses that are both durable and cheap to make, or whatever it is. It's not clear whether there's going to be any profit from this, and in fact, we might even operate at a loss. But because our criterion here, we might make a profit, to the extent that that can be measured, but we're quite capable of committing enormous resources in terms of socialized investment for projects that the rationale for which is not private profit, but social benefit. So I think to the extent that populations are both hard-pressed by stagnating capitalism and might begin to perceive, hopefully with some examples of societies doing this, that things could be done differently and better, that in fact, you know, socialism might be better at no growth than capitalism is. I think to the extent that that happens, we've got an inkling of how to transition from this manifestly suicidal to a different one.
Okay, now I speak.
I think now we discuss.
Oh, we discuss. Okay, I thought it was a 5-minute thing that I was supposed to do.
No. You can respond if I
have. I just thought that then you listed that materials covered. Stop.
Now you get a 20-minute conversation.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess I have a few things I'd just like to say in response to a very rich reflection of that part. About the, you know, interesting thing about the GDP, he accentuated its system specificity in a way in terms of how do we measure wealth and all these kinds of problems and the way that these things were resolved in the course of the 20th century. One of the things I like to say often, but just to show the sort of arbitrariness of the way in which wealth is measured in capitalist GDP statistics, is that let's assume a lot of the population, a lot more of the population, got cancer. And there had to be an expansion of services to provide for all these new cancer cases. That would be registered as a growth of GDP. So the more cancer we got, in that sense, in a society in which, you know, there would be treatment of cancer, the wealthier we'd be. And we see that there's something wrong with that. But I think it gets back to some interesting theoretical questions about the nature of wealth and the nature of growth in terms of whether or not, and this is where maybe Ben and I would put things a bit differently, whether or not we're talking about the end of growth or whether or not we're talking about the end of a particular socially specific form of wealth and the growth imperative that's built into that. I mean, Marx has this conception of socially specific wealth. Let me give an example that might clarify what I mean. Swords and castles were a way of appropriating wealth in the feudal mode of production. And it's not that capitalism, when it came around, produced more swords and castles. It produced other kinds of wealth. So you can imagine a society which, of course, although it wouldn't be producing the kinds of wealth that dominate the
growth process of capitalism would produce a whole new range of goods and services of a kind that can't be produced in a capitalist system. Now, in a certain sense, how wealth would be measured and how it would be allocated in that economy would therefore be specific to the logic of that mode of production, to use the term Marx used. And I think that's a way that we might think about, in a way, this period of transition to another social form, if in fact people don't like the idea of stagnation, because the dominant, let's say, ideology, which we all in a certain sense subscribe to in the Western societies and modern societies, is that stagnation and steady stateness is bad and dynamism is good. And I don't have any problem with people thinking those things. And so maybe it would be better to argue that instead of there being a kind of stagnation or steady condition in terms of no growth or degrowth or whatever, the better way to put the argument would be that there would be a fundamentally different framework for determining what wealth is, the quantities and qualities of it, and that's the kind of way in which we should think of the transition from one form of society to another. I guess that's sort of just a little
bit. Yeah, and I think, the nice thing to me about this sort of vision of the steady state economy is its minimalism, which is just to say, go and do whatever you want, just make sure you don't mine too much of this, you don't log too much of that, and you don't emit too much of that. And having set those very basic parameters, a society can really more or less do what it wants. It's interesting to read an essay like Keynes's great essay on economic possibilities for grandchildren. We're now like at the age of his what would have been his great grandchildren at the time, because on the one hand, I think things look an essay like that exhibits a sort of blindness in most of the 20th century, just thinking growth will happen automatically forever. And also gives a sense of like how we might get beyond these measurements. I mean, on the one hand, Keynes says something like, well, compound interest has been running forever, and just keep running for a few more generations, then everybody should be so wealthy that they won't have to work very much. And you think compound interest does not by itself create anything, and it's a type of madness to imagine that you could basically just leave a pile of money somewhere and that would eventually supply all of people's material wants. However, when he says that once the economic problem is solved, people will be faced with their real problem, which is basically what to do with your time and what is valuable, I think that's the type of situation where we're looking at, in which we might say, well, the ultimate unit of economics is, at least on a marginalist account, is meant to be utility, right? Which is basically just happiness. And yet none of us sit around thinking like, satisfaction. My utility is increasing. That's not quite how we put it, but we're quite interested in whether we feel like we're happier than we were last year or less so, and whether people around us are happier or less so, or more or less satisfied. And it seems to me that potentially a increasingly satisfied society would would lose its ability to measure these things, having pretended, as we still do now, that it once upon a time did have good statistics for such things.
So, one of the ways in which I would frame this in economic terms is that if we think about what the capitalist system is as a price system, what prices are is the determination of relative scarcity of things in relationship to people's preferences. And so when we think about, in a way, a kind of affluent society in the sense that Keynes and socialists go beyond Keynes conceived of it, you could think of a society in which, in a certain sense, lots of things would be in abundance to such a degree that there would no longer be proper price for them, right? Like, just as over the course of the evolution of the capitalist system, price that we pay for things like running water or for public education or for a lot of things, at least for a period of time, became close to zero, at least a small utility payment basically maintain these enormous services. So in a certain sense, we would want to think about a kind of abundance, in a certain sense, that would arise in a post-capitalist economy. And I'm just trying to think about how we might sort of integrate this to a conception in which there would be a very strict accounting regime with respect to lots of things in our economic system that don't get a price or don't get a cost, like the devastation to the economy, the kind of drudgery of, you know, of a lot of social life, basically, has a huge cost to it. And the kind of economic system that might be able to improve human welfare is one which would, in a certain sense, paradoxically, stop pricing certain things, offer them in abundance, and begin to kind of attach, as it were, cost to lots of things that within this system appear as costless as so-called externalities. So that's one way we might want to frame this in terms of the economic logic. I guess so.
Yeah, I mean, it would be, I don't know what a socialist society would want to do it, and presumably it would develop and, you know, change its own preferences over time. But insofar as we retained for a while a kind of economic accounting, a dollar accounting of how we were doing, there are models for how to try and incorporate these things. I mean, one thing that ecological economists point out is that there's a type of madness in our society that we would recognize as madness if it were to characterize, like, let's say, a particular heir of a wealthy family, which is to say, he has a bunch of capital, and he's just running through it because the capital consists of, like, the forest on his estate and the petroleum deposits. And if this person's like has more and more income every year, no one would think, "Well, you're doing great. Think you're really growing." Like, you think, this is insane, and you're just like heading for a fall, because in fact you have these enormous assets which certainly ought to have a dollar value and do as they're depleted, and which will have, you know, higher ones as they get more scarce. You're running through these things that you failed to account for economically, which you really ought to do. And so while it seems that your wealth is growing, it's actually shrinking. And at the same time, of course, as you point out, there are things that are just registered as economic activity that are harmful. Some of the, like Kuznets, when he was first coming up with this sort of concept or a measurement of GDP, felt that armaments should be deducted and advertising should be deducted. And, you know, one can imagine other things, like sort of pharmaceuticals, right? Like, are we a better country because, like, we consume more antidepressants than other countries? Presumably not. Like, countries where people spend a lot of time in traffic have there's more economic activity because they're just sitting there idling in their cars than if they had, walked to work for 2 minutes. And, the Norwegians, for a couple of years after the Second World War, when everybody was beginning to sort of standardize and compare their national accounts figures, did offer kind of a supplement where they'd say, we haven't included in our stats, but we really should, and so should everybody else, non-commodified housework, right? That's to say, it's obviously a good and a service if somebody makes a sandwich for you and eat the sandwich, and you can go, like, get one at Pret a Manger, and you can also make one at home, and it's quite mad if you think, like, well, it's worth nothing if I ate it at home, and it's worth $7 if I got it or something. But even the Norwegians stopped doing that after a couple of years. But one can kind of imagine, insofar as these figures were retained at all, trying to make them slightly more rational. And some, ecological economists have sometimes tried to think about doing that.
Okay, so sort of just one comment. I thought maybe if other people just wanted to weigh in and ask after that. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say something on behalf of capitalism, devil's advocate position. Now, somebody who's a kind of rational defender of capitalist system would be saying something like, well,
Why isn't it the case that the same dynamic, I admit that it slowed down in this particular period, dynamic innovation and cost cutting, if you remember, the cost cutting dynamic of the system is what classical economists and Marx thought was the source of the surplus that allowed for the investment and the growth of productivity. So the whole, the perpetuation of the whole dynamic really requires that there be a constant stream of cost-cutting innovations which lower the cost of life for most people, and in fact provide them not just with more things, but with a greater variety of things. And that's how the system is expanded. That's why a surplus arises. It takes less labor, less overall social wealth to produce any unit of output, basically, and that frees up that labor and social wealth, however you measure that, for the allocation towards other forms of production or towards an expansion of production. So the basic thing that we're talking about here is a pattern of technological development. So lots of shortages of various kinds, could they not be solved technologically? Food shortage, resource shortage, particularly with respect to energy, all kinds of things are afoot and potentially could drastically reduce the cost of living and therefore immense expansion of disposable income if they could become profitable. The problem is all this technological possibility exists there, and yet the barriers to making this stuff profitable are really what we're talking about. It's not because we're running out of technologies or bright ideas for the creation of social wealth, the reduction of the cost of producing social wealth. So the basic, what I would conclude from this in response to the person who wants to say that this could in fact continue after all, it depends upon various things, electrical cars and self-driving, automation, all these things are still going to happen. Are they going to save the capital system? And I would argue that they're not, because there's not any way to make this stuff profitable. The profit mechanism in the system depends upon employing people. And so what we've seen in this kind of period is a slowdown of growth that's resulting in part from the fact that the dynamic tendencies of the system are labor saving still, but they're manifesting themselves in the form of ever fewer people having to work, and ever fewer people having to be employed means there's less aggregate demand. And so a system, we have dystopian visions of a kind of capitalist system which workers could be replaced by robots. That can't be the case. The source of the surplus income, the driving condition of possibility is the wage relationship, and people have to be paid wages in order to be able to buy the products. And so you will see a pattern of technological growth in this period of stagnation. We already see with Amazon and Google and all these sorts of things, and that will reduce the level of employment in society and make certain things ever cheaper, but it will not make a large number of things which are increasingly impossible for the capitalist system to reduce the cost of. Education, healthcare, and most particularly we see this in cities, rent, basically. So capitalism isn't able to solve those problems. It isn't able to drastically reduce the cost of those services, basically. And this is what I was saying before. And I think that if you were to think about ways in which you could overcome this obstacle, like, for instance, during the Second World War, and aftermath, social housing, making things cheaper in terms of education, healthcare, that could happen. But really what that would mean is this sort of, you could say the capitalist system would be saved by halfway turning it into a socialist system. So the various things that could save the capitalism, that save economic growth in the sense of living standards, would be measures that would basically bring us ever closer towards the supersession of the existing system that we have. Like even the sort of interventions in the economy that we saw during the Second World War, massive interventions that really got the capitalist system going again, if even those things were to be repeated now in an attempt to reactivate income, employ people, we'd have to cut wages,
sorry, we'd have to cut the amount of hours people work. We'd have to do a whole bunch of things that would really drastically change the shape of the socioeconomic order. So the very, the punchline is the very things that would save the standard of living and allow for people to live better would be things that now would entail breaking away from the private properties, profit-steered system that we have.
Yeah, I suppose that, you know, what I was trying to say about kind of growthlessness goes for labor saving as well. Like, this can be the very same condition, in a sense, can be a nightmare, or it can be a kind of utopia. So what looks like a terrible problem, which is that we don't need that much labor anymore to produce a certain result. Yeah, this right now, it just looks like a recipe for social disaster and misery, and the very same technical situation, we don't need that much labor to produce this amount of stuff. You know, it looks like, it, at least conceptually, quite easy to flip into a kind of utopian situation.
Yeah, I guess what I'd say would also be that, I mean, in order to drastically reduce the costs here of living in the city, we have to have more of that stuff in relationship to the number of people. And so there would have to be lots of things that would be massive benefit. It should be the right of people to come and live in the city and do so cheaply. And the fact that there's a restriction on the supply of certain things makes them much more expensive in relationship to it. We've all become wealthier in terms of gadgets and clothes that are produced in China, but we've become poorer and poorer in relationship to rent and the cost of education and essential services of that kind. So that's the primary thing that the capital system cannot solve. And that's one of the reasons why that cost of living reducing source of surplus is slowing down. And that's the reason why the system has to rely in order to prop up return on ever-growing levels of inequality, rich take a larger share of a slower growing pie, and in order to keep the whole thing rolling over, a growth in the level of debt to make up for what people couldn't otherwise buy out of their wages.
Yeah. I think that's probably it for us going back and forth, and we have time for some questions, yeah?
Go ahead. Yeah, I think what we're talking about is trying to begin to decouple the socialist vision for the 21st century from the 19th century religion of progress with a capital T, which Marx and Engels being people of the 19th century weren't immune to. And so I think we're talking about beginning to think about how the production of wealth, we're redefining wealth. We're talking about another thing I think we ought to be talking a lot more about is remediation and devoting resources to planting vast forests of trees that remove carbon from the atmosphere, deploying solar panels on a large scale, finding ways to, above all, to be relying on renewable goods and services, and reducing the use of things that really are finite, like carbon and fossil fuels, but also like minerals and you know, the whole number of things that are, you take them out and you use them and then they're basically gone, they're used up, they're not going to be replaced. Sort of grand scale recycling, you know, all of which requires a society based not on private profit, but on the needs of the associated producers, the working people that make things happen. So I like your whole beginning to develop that vision. It's a good direction to be going in.
I saw somebody put your hand up as well. Yeah.
My question relates to the cancer GDP comment. Because just this morning on the Herald, they were talking about how the rebuilding after natural disasters actually boosts GDP.
Of course, yeah.
And so I was wondering instead of slowing growth, how can capitalism actually take advantage of climate change and the increasing frequency of natural disasters?
Yeah, I mean, if you think of the kind of wealth and value form, I mean, you could say that, of course, it grows, you know, obviously, it seems to grow in the context that we're talking about, more people having cancer, a natural disaster reconstruction, and stuff like that. But of course, we have to think of what Morris was getting to when he sort of said that there's a duality of wealth in the capitalist system. Sort of value form of it. There's a use value side, right? So ultimately, wealth in a capitalist society has to manifest itself in the growth of use values, quantities and qualities of the kinds of things that give people, individuals, satisfaction. I mean, and there's a historical standard, as it were, to what that is. And so we have a society in which, in nominal terms, you could say that GDP has expanded or will expand and what have you, and how long that will last is a question. But we have now discovered, or people have now discovered, that this is taking place against the context of, within a context of 30 years of wage stagnation. So we're really dealing with a very interesting kind of dialectics here in terms of the value form of wealth and the use value aspect of things and the way in which these come into contradiction to one another. That's a very abstract way of putting it, but I'm trying to make the kind of theoretical framework of Marx, in a certain sense, speak to, you know, the kind of things we're dealing with at this level. I don't know, did I answer that?
I see that in for society as a whole, I mean, it's super problematic, but I wonder if you see, people taking advantage of it.
Yeah.
Not that it would keep working,
okay,
so well, capitalism continue, but
right. Good. Yeah, so what would it basically be the devil's advocate situation is that as costs rise because of global warming, there would be increasing returns to figuring out how to reduce costs in the form of alternate technologies. So if you were to think about the way that capitalism could adapt to ecological crisis, it would be this story, basically. Rising costs create the incentive, basically, for capitalists to introduce innovation that creates the price structure, right? So if oil were to go up as it has in this period, we now have the great technological innovation of shale, which makes for a massively expanded supply of oil in the world. We will never see, therefore, a rising price of oil in the manner in which we've seen it over much of the 20th century, because there's now this latent capacity to kick in that brings the price down immediately whenever supply exceeds demand. And something like that, you could say, has always been how the capitalist system has dealt with scarcity and therefore rising costs and the kind of dynamism that brings it back down. Now, this could all be going on still, and yet the world could become ever shittier and more horrible, and yet something like the mechanism in place behind that could kick in. And it could be the case that we might be passing, even in a society which is no longer capitalist, if we're talking about moving from 7 billion people to 10 billion people, there is going to be a pretty big ecological impact of that. And so these kinds of pressures to figure out ways of reducing, not just reducing costs, but counteracting the deterioration in the environment are things that have to be figured out. And not really likely that this profit mechanism is going to do a great job at it, although you can see the sort of form of how it would adapt, even though that might be very below optimal and be compatible with quite significant deterioration of quality of life.
I think we've got a couple, maybe we'll go. So the guy in the middle of the second row, and then hit you, and that may be about as much as we can chat with.
So you talked about the steady state as being kind of this minimalist project into which you can build potential futures. And you guys were talking about the some potentially socialist exit out of growth-based capitalism. And you guys are pretty honest about the fact that the outline of how this transition might happen doesn't really exist, that we don't have a model for it. But I just was wondering if either one of you could take up this question of if that transition happened not towards socialism but towards some type of ecological fascism that battened down the hatches nationally and thought of, I mean, and there are some kind of intellectual strains of this now. They're not strong and there's no political formation around it, but I mean, Bush can talk about some like the 80s and stuff, and there's some kind of British nationalism after Brexit, like Paul Kingsnorth and stuff. Like that, what might that look like, and what would be the proper kind of updated ecological response to that in the political field?
I think that's a great question. I mean, I don't know. I think we'll find out, and it could be we could learn some ugly things. But I think it's true that, to take a quite extreme, but obviously a very real example, I mean, I think that, you know, Nazism was to a degree an ecological project, and although I'm not a huge fan of Timothy Snyder's work, I think that aspect of his argument makes sense, right? There's this sense that, we need, a country is strong to the degree that it's got a lot of people and can field a big army and can grow a lot of food for those people and has space in which to put, that there are good, like, German babies, and, like, it would not be bad to starve to death, some tens of millions of Slavs implant ourselves in their place. I mean, that's a type of ecology, and obviously, like, the worst possible kind. And, it seems to me, like, rightly stigmatizes sort of lifeboat ethics, right? Like, there's only so much space for us here in the life raft, and we're going to have to make sure that these refugees don't climb on out of the Mediterranean, as it were. I don't know what our response to that is, except to say, to oppose it in every possible way. Of course, it may need to be opposed in the sort of classical way of militarily. I mean, I hate to think about this, but also, I mean, I hope before it comes to that, like in the creation of societies that are simply much more attractive to live in and that may acquire some of their strength. I mean, I've tried to, just sort of beginning to think about this, how this might work. But, there are certainly countries that are, that have like enormous, they're just big tracts of land that you could fill with many, many more people. The United States is one of them. I mean, there are lots of them, others, much of in South America or something. Much of Africa too. A country like Holland is probably a bad example, but where you might be able to say, like, maybe global population doesn't need to grow, but like this country, it's going to become a better country, a stronger country, a richer country. The more people it has, and they're not going to look like the people who were, who were here, that we've expected to be here before. I hope that a way of dealing with sort of immigration will be not so much the sort of the defensive way of approaching it, which we think we have now, and kind of rightly so, right? Which is say, like, we know that we need to do this, and it's like really morally the thing to do, but like this is actually going to make our societies that much better to accommodate these problems in sort of that way rather than in the way of the sort of Lebensraum way. Mm-hmm. That's the beginning of the answer.
I was going to say that, because I want to jump in there too, that one of the things I was trying to argue, and I just did a very sketch-like form, was that underneath the kind of surface of this great capitalist leap forward that we've seen over the last 30, 35 years since the 1980s, early 80s, associated with this period of neoliberalism, has been, I argue, the growing role of debt, particularly public debt, in supporting the system. And as I said before, think that this is the way in which ultimately what's going on
could be seen as a beginning transition to another socioeconomic order. So it's not like the capital system, you know, is continuing, and if it collapses, we'll be confronted with these kind of stark alternatives. That's partly true, but really the framework for, in a certain sense, the emergence of another socioeconomic order has been taking shape with underneath this dynamic of privatization, publicly subsidized. And so the next time there's a failure of the markets, we are actually going to see, whether it takes a nation statist or a larger internationalist form, a stark alternative between bailing out all these property owners and attempting to kind of get the ball rolling again at huge public cost, or simply taking that step over and refusing to let the meltdown of the markets bring down everything else with it. Parks, libraries, education, all that sort of stuff. If society wants to preserve these things, it'll have to phase down the private ownership of social wealth and large spheres of social reproduction, which are governed by the profit rate. So I think that it's not the case, like getting to this issue of scientific versus utopian socialism, of, you know, well, capitalism has these deficiencies, let's think of something new to replace it. The basic objective parameters in which we will be thinking about them will result from this crisis, and then it becomes a question of the role of politics in shaping those outcomes. Now, the path of socialization I describe is, to put it classically, a open-ended one, in so much as it can progress in a progressive socialist direction, or towards what was once known as barbarism, socialism or barbarism, right? Or some peculiar combinations of the two, I don't know. The basic point being that the reason why this nation-statist version of attempting to shore up what we have amidst the kind of collapse of everything around it, that was what basically took place in the 1930s. Briefly, fascism was a successful state capitalist response to the collapse of the world market. That's not going to work anymore, because it's just not going to be the case that the Lebensraum expansion war route is going to pay off. There's no way that that can happen again without just collapsing the system. That was the last period in which the attempt to kind of use massive amounts of force to kind of bring back the capitalist system by kind of turning it into a kind of quasi military slave system, it didn't work. It lasted for about 12 years and it was wiped out, and it's not going to happen again. So we're going to have nasty, ugly, right-wing backlash politics, but those people are not going to be able to get the system to work again if they come to power, even for a little while. And that's the difference between then and now, because then there was a possibility that in some very perverse sense it could have worked or whatever. It would have shifted the whole path of historical development down some very weird and unforeseen kind of trajectory, but that's not going to happen. And so really this, what we're saying, I mean, it could be that things just crap out and go down, but this is really the only alternative, this larger, more solidaristic international solution. Because, you know, the wealth of society is now basically a product of an international division of labor, and there's no way to access it except by, you know, one's participation in it, and that requires that these solutions are ones from top to bottom are going to unfold at an international level. Otherwise, there will be a massive deterioration of standard of living, there will be an ongoing reduction of quality of life, and that will eventually affect these little lifeboat kind of, you know, enclaves as well. So, you know, I mean, people don't always react rationally in a crisis. Populations often act very irrationally, and so that could happen. So I'm not saying it's inevitable that what I'm saying, the good scenario, is going to materialize, but there is no other solution other than the good scenario.
I want to get to your question and the last one.
Okay.
you probably hear where I'm from. You talk about mostly theoretical, yes? I could say something practical, and I was subjected to real socialism for most of my life, and I live here for like 20 years. So the thing is, I'm not saying socialism is good or bad. I'm not on either side. And actually, several days ago at NYU, Yanis Katsonis had a lecture where he was saying that this type of socialism that we rejected, probably not only type of socialism, but let me say what I loved when I came here and compare what I had, what I really like there. For example, no advertisement, no at all. Of course, great education, universal healthcare, but it was not that simple. Good healthcare was available for particular only people. So that we started that saying that there will be problem of distribution. And that was, and when we talk about socialism here, we talk about usually distribution of wealth, universal basic income, something like this. Everybody have money. Yes, but this is the problem, biggest problem in socialism. And it's probably too long to describe how it worked, but on the lower level of society, people did not have basic things, and the whole country just stealing everything from work, from government, and it was not a sin at all because there was no anything in the store. So it's there are bad and good sides of it, but what I'm saying, we still, from my point of view, have to discuss honestly this type of socialism, because probably it will be very close to something that was in Soviet Union, probably, because they tried many different ways and could not create something perfect. So we should honestly discuss what is going on here, what was there, and compare and actually start to build it, because right now there is a way for fair distribution, which wasn't possible in the Soviet Union. Right now we have, okay, computer. We could, that it's, people never be able to distribute it fair, because I have friends, I have relatives. I want my daughter to have more than your daughter. I'm sorry. You see, and that goes, and when it goes to the, and not because I'm bad, because I'm rude, because I want my friends and relatives be in good condition. It's not. It's my best intention and interest. So that's, it's a lot of psychological, and it's, I don't think that it will be. Chaotically by itself somehow arise. It's still, there should be people who discuss it and really understand what was wrong there, what was wrong here, and somehow try to create new theory how we can build something better.
I think that's the last point. If I said anything which would suggest that this thing that I'm talking about, the alternative, would automatically come into place without the role of ideas and of politically thinking about the shape of society. I didn't mean that, so thank you for that intervention and correction of emphasis there. Well, I mean, I'm not really too concerned about the human nature aspect. It seems that human beings are pretty different in different kinds of societies and different periods, and I think that to the degree that the primary reason why people compete for resources is due to scarcity of them. And so obviously in a society like the Soviet Union, communist societies, the managed scarcity system, and so obviously kind of dynamics of competition. But obviously psychology and people competing about other things. There's nothing wrong with any of that stuff. And so it's not a problem getting rid of people wanting to be. It's the society that, you know, we should think of is not one which has any utopian assumptions about changing the way human beings essentially are. That can happen too over the course of time. I guess to get to the main point that you were making, which is that with respect to socialism as being a solution to the maturation of the system, as opposed to socialism in the 20th century, which was often thought of as a strategy of economic development. Most of the time, when Marx conceived of socialism in the 19th century, he assumed it would happen in the most advanced capitalist countries, right? But of course, in the 20th century, contrary to that expectation, socialist revolutions, revolutions calling themselves socialists, took place in backward countries. Russia was thought to be too backward to have socialism when there was a revolution there. But every revolution that happened after that took place in a country that was even more backward than Russia. And so the kind of context in which socialism arose in these backward countries was an attempt to catch up to capitalism through a form of administratively driven growth, taking wealth from the countryside and promoting industry. And that took place in a context of military and political rivalry and encirclement by the Western dominated part of the system. So that whole process of building attempted planned economies took place under conditions which were very far removed from the initial ideas of how a transition to socialism would unfold under conditions of the maturing of capitalist social relations. So we should always keep in mind that although this experience is very relevant, it really doesn't speak much any longer to the larger historical situation of this period in which the capitalist system itself is no longer delivering the rates of growth which have made the system work really and succeed and beat its rivals over the last century and a half. So I think perhaps the point that Ben was making was that the relevance there of the past is and clearly the weight of the failure of what was called socialism weighs very heavily on the minds of people all over the world. Workers all over the world used to believe in socialism, and because of these failures and perceived failures, they no longer believe in that. So we're in a dangerous situation in which we're in a system that's broken and not going to be fixed. And the main ideas of the tradition that once presented an alternative have seemingly been ruled out of court. And so it's, you know, it's a problem that won't be solved automatically. That's for sure.
Jenny's suggesting me.
Okay.
Maybe I could answer very succinctly. I feel bad having noticed you before. What was your?
I was going to ask to what extent you thought that historical and especially contemporary radical notions of emancipation, which seems often to be tied up with ideas of like advancing individual autonomy, often are tied up with sort of a capitalist and maybe from a biophysical perspective, carbon-intensive notion of growth, and whether this is something that might need to be. This is something that can actually be fulfilled in your vision of state economy, or if this is actually. We will be looking at hard constraints in terms of.
That's a very good question, and I perceive that we've kind of run out of time, which means that, like, in some sense, I'm exempted from having to answer it. I think a book that's like worth thinking about along the lines is Timothy Mitchell's Carbon Democracy, which sort of talks about the way in which having this energy surplus may have been a precondition for the relative emancipation, obviously only very relative, that took place for a lot of working people in modern times. I think that it looks to me at least that things might remain efficient enough in a steady state sort of supplying people with a basic material basis for their lives, that hopefully that, you know, you don't have a lot of political coercion or any, in fact. But it seems that also we might be looking at a situation in which people simply have a lot of free time. I think that that's one place to look for emancipation. But I think that we'll try about asking your free time where your free time begins now. Thanks for coming.